resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Memory training. We have seen what an important part environment and habit play in connection with concentration. We shall now discuss a third subject that is related to concentration, and that is memory. The three principles through which an accurate, unfaltering memory may be trained are few and comparatively simple. Number 1. Retention. The receiving of a sense impression through one or more of the five senses and the recording of this impression in the mind. As stated earlier, this process may be likened to the recording of a picture on the plate of a camera. Number 2. Recall. The reviving or recalling into the conscious mind of those sense impressions that have been recorded in the subconscious mind. This process may be compared to the act of going through a card index and pulling out a card on which information had been previously recorded. Number 3. Recognition. The ability to recognize a sense impression when it is called into the conscious mind and to identify it as being a duplicate of the original impression, then to associate it with the original source from which it came when it was first recorded. This process enables us to distinguish between memory and imagination. Now let us make application of these principles and determine how to use them effectively. First, when you wish to be sure of your ability to recall a sense impression, such as a name, date, or place, be sure to make the impression vivid by concentrating on it to the finest detail. An effective way to do this is to repeat the information several times. Just as a photographer must give an exposure proper time to record itself on the plate of the camera, so must we give the subconscious mind time to properly and clearly record any sense impression that we wish to be able to recall readily. Next, associate whatever you wish to remember with some other object, name, place, or date that is familiar to you, such as the name of your hometown, a close friend, your birth date, and so on. Along with the sense impression that you can easily recall, your mind will also store the one that you may not recall as easily. Later, bringing the familiar impression into the conscious mind will also bring the other with it. Repeat that which you wish to remember a number of times, while at the same time concentrating your mind on it. The common failing of not being able to remember the names of other people, which most of us have, is due entirely to the fact that we do not properly record the name in the first place. When you are introduced to a new person, repeat their name 4 or 5 times, first making sure that you understood the name correctly. If the name is similar to that of someone else you know, associate the two names, thinking of both as you repeat the name of the new person. The law of association is the most important feature of a well-trained memory, and it is also a very simple law. If someone gives you a letter to be mailed, look at the letter, then increase its size in your imagination and see it hanging over a mailbox. Fix in your mind a letter approximately the size of a door, then associate it with a mailbox, and you will observe that the first mailbox you pass on the street will cause you to recall that big, odd-looking letter that you have in your pocket. Suppose that you were introduced to a lady whose name was Elizabeth Shearer, and you wish to be able to recall her name at will. As you repeat her name, associate with it a large pair of scissors, perhaps 10 feet in length, and Queen Elizabeth, and you will observe that recalling either the large pair of scissors or the name of Queen Elizabeth will also help you recall the name of Elizabeth Shearer. Nearly 10 years ago, a friend gave me his residence telephone number in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and although I did not write it down, I remember it today as well as I did the day he gave it to me. The exchange and number were Lakeview 2651. At the time he gave it to me, we were standing at the railroad station, in sight of Lake Michigan. Therefore, I used the lake as an associated object with which to file the name of the telephone exchange. It so happened that the telephone number was made up of the age of my brother, who was 26, and my father, who was 51. So I associated their names and ages with the number. To recall the telephone exchange and number, I had only to think of Lake Michigan, my brother, and my father. Editor's Commentary. As Napoleon Hill notes, there are only a few basic memory techniques, and while his explanation covers the classic methods, he does so in rather simple terms. From the many books on the subject and the memory courses that are widely promoted in every media from magazines to infomercials, it would seem that there must be more to it. And there is. The more to it is the many variations on the basic techniques. Though it may all boil down to repetition, association, and recall of sense impressions, there are many inventive methods by which you can put them into practice, especially the techniques of association and sense impression. None of the available books or courses can offer magic, but they do give you interesting tools to work with. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. An acquaintance of mine found himself to be suffering from what is often called a wandering mind. He was becoming absent-minded and unable to remember. In his own words, this is how he overcame that handicap. I am 50 years old. For a decade, I have been a department manager in a large factory. At first, my duties were easy. Then the firm had a rapid expansion of business, which gave me added responsibilities. Several of the young men in my department developed unusual energy and ability, and at least one of them had his eye on my job. I had reached the age in life when a man likes to be comfortable, and having been with the company a long time, I felt that I could safely settle back into an easy berth. The effect of this attitude was disastrous to my position. About 2 years ago, I noticed that my power of concentration was weakening. I neglected my correspondence until I looked with dread upon the formidable pile of letters. Reports accumulated, and subordinates were inconvenienced by the delay. I sat at my desk with my mind wandering elsewhere. Other circumstances also showed plainly that my mind was not on my work. I forgot to attend an important meeting of the officers of the company. Another time, one of the clerks under me caught a bad mistake I had made in an estimate on a carload of goods, and, of course, saw to it that the manager learned of the incident. I was thoroughly alarmed at the situation and asked for a week's vacation to think things over. I was determined either to resign or to find the trouble and remedy it. A few days of earnest introspection at an out-of-the-way mountain resort convinced me that I was suffering from a plain case of mind wandering. My physical and mental activities at my desk had become haphazard. I was careless, shiftless, and neglectful, all because my mind was not alertly on the job. I needed a complete new set of working habits, and I made a resolve to acquire them. With paper and pencil, I outlined a schedule to cover the working day. First, the morning mail. Then, the orders to be filled. Dictation, conference with subordinates, and miscellaneous duties, ending with a clean desk before I left. I asked myself how habits are formed, and my answer was, by repetition. I realized that I have been doing these things over and over thousands of times, but not in an orderly, concentrated fashion. I returned to the office and put my new working schedule in force at once. I performed the same duties with the same zest and, as nearly as possible, at the same time every day. When my mind started to slip away, I quickly brought it back. From a mental stimulus created by willpower, I progressed in habit building. Day after day, I practiced concentration of thought. When I found repetition becoming comfortable, then I knew I had won. Your ability to train your memory or to develop any desired habit is solely a matter of being able to fix your attention on a given subject until the outline of that subject has been thoroughly impressed upon your mind. Concentration itself is nothing but a matter of control of your attention. You will observe that by reading a line of print with which you are not familiar and which you have never seen before, and then closing your eyes, you can see that line as plainly as though you were looking at it on the printed page. In reality, you are looking at it, not on the page, but on the sensitized plate of your own mind. If you try this experiment and it does not work the first time, it is because you did not concentrate your attention on the line closely enough. Repeat the process a few times, and finally you will succeed. If you wish to memorize poetry, for example, you can do so very quickly by training yourself to fix your attention on the lines so closely that, again, you can shut your eyes and see them in your mind as plainly as you see them on the printed page. So significant is this subject of control of attention that I must emphasize it strongly. I consider it, by far, the most important part of the lesson. Put the hypothesis to a test of your own. You can select no better subject than your definite chief aim in life. Memorize your definite chief aim so you can repeat it without looking at the written page, then make a practice of fixing your attention on it at least twice a day. Go to a quiet place where you will not be disturbed. Sit down and completely relax your mind and your body. Then, close your eyes and place your fingers in your ears, thereby blocking all light and all ordinary sound waves. Then, repeat your definite chief aim in life, and as you do so, in your imagination, see yourself in full possession of the object of that aim. If a part of your aim is the accumulation of money, as it undoubtedly is, then see yourself in possession of that money. If a part of the object of your definite chief aim is to own a home, then see a picture of that home in your imagination, just as you expect to see it in reality. If a part of your definite chief aim is to become a powerful and influential public speaker, then see yourself before an enormous audience and feel yourself playing on the emotions of that audience as a great violinist would play on the strings of a violin. Begin now to cultivate the ability to fix attention at will on a given subject with the feeling that this ability, when fully developed, would bring you the object of your definite chief aim in life. Persuasion versus force. Success, as has been stated in dozens of different ways throughout this course, is very largely a matter of tactful and harmonious negotiation with other people. Generally speaking, the person who understands how to get people to do things they want done may succeed in any calling. I will now describe the principles through which people are influenced, through which cooperation is gained, and through which antagonism is eliminated and friendliness developed. Force sometimes gets what appear to be satisfactory results, but force alone never has built and never can build enduring success. The human body can be imprisoned or controlled by physical force, but it is not so with the human mind. No one can control the mind of a normal, healthy person if that person chooses to exercise their God-given right to control their own mind. The majority of people do not exercise this right. They go through the world, thanks to our faulty educational system, without having discovered the strength that lies dormant in their own minds. Now and then, something happens that awakens a person and causes them to discover where their real strength lies, and how to use it in the development of industry or one of the professions. Result? A genius is born. There is a given point at which the human mind stops rising or exploring unless something out of the daily routine happens to push it over this obstacle. The individual who discovers a way to stimulate his or her mind artificially, to cause it to go beyond this average stopping point frequently, is sure to be rewarded with fame and fortune if their efforts are of a constructive nature. Editor's Commentary. Hill's own mind never did reach its stopping point, although he found it taking an unexpected direction at the same time he reached what he'd intended would be semi-retirement. W. Clement Stone had been a devotee of Napoleon Hill's philosophies since he first read Think and Grow Rich in 1938. The owner of an insurance company selling $1 travel policies, Stone had purchased many thousands of copies of the book, making it required reading for each of his thousands of salespeople. In 1952, Stone's friend and dentist, Dr. Herb Gustafson, had recommended Napoleon Hill as speaker for a dental convention in Chicago. It was to have been one of Hill's last public engagements, and Gustafson invited Stone to attend. When they met, Stone told Hill of the numerous copies he had bought of Think and Grow Rich, and that he attributed his success and great wealth to that book. In A Lifetime of Riches, author Michael Ritt says that, to Hill, it was an endorsement of his life's work, and it came from a man who was more than accomplished. Stone was, in Hill's eyes, an empire builder cut from the same mold as the giants of early 20th century American industry whose philosophies had provided the basis for Hill's principles of success. W. Clement Stone's primary goals were to increase his business from a $32 million enterprise to $100 million and personally to use his wealth and knowledge to create a better world for this and future generations. He called this his magnificent obsession. They were philosophically in perfect harmony. Stone persuaded Hill to forget about retirement, and by the end of the luncheon, they had created the foundation for what would be the strongest mastermind alliance of Hill's career. To further spread Hill's message, Stone would manage his activities and provide financial backing. They formed Napoleon Hill Associates. Stone's business goal was more than realized. With Hill motivating his staff, the company's assets reached $900 million. To reach what was the personal goal of both, Napoleon Hill Associates produced books, courses, lectures, inspirational films, radio programs, and eventually television shows. The success of their business partnership and mastermind alliance continued until 1961, always with a handshake, never a contract. Their friendship continued throughout the rest of Hill's life. Napoleon Hill died November 8, 1970, at the age of 87. W. Clement Stone died September 3, 2002, at the age of 100. Having fulfilled his magnificent obsession by donating more than $275 million to various charities over his lifetime. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. The educator who discovers a way to stimulate any mind and cause it to rise above its usual stopping point without any bad reactionary effects will confer a blessing on humanity second to none. I'm not referring to physical stimulants, I am referring to a purely mental stimulant, such as that which comes through intense interest, desire, enthusiasm, love, and so on, the factors out of which a mastermind may be developed. The person who makes this discovery will also do much toward solving the crime problem. You can do almost anything with a person when you learn how to influence their mind. The mind may be likened to a great field. It is a very fertile field that always produces a crop of the kind of seed that is sown in it. The problem, then, is to learn how to select the right sort of seed and how to sow that seed so that it takes root and grows quickly. We are sowing seed in our minds every second, but we are doing it more or less unconsciously. We must learn to do it following a carefully prepared plan according to a well-laid-out design. Haphazardly sown seed in the human mind brings back a haphazard crop. There is no escape from this result. History is full of notable cases of men who have been transformed from law-abiding, peaceful, constructive citizens to vicious criminals. We also have thousands of cases wherein criminals have been transformed into constructive, law-abiding citizens. In every one of these cases, the transformation of the human being took place in the mind of the man. He created in his own mind, for one reason or another, a picture of what he desired and then proceeded to transform that picture into reality. If a picture of any environment, condition, or thing is envisioned in the human mind, and if the mind is focused or concentrated on that picture long enough and persistently enough, and backed up with a strong desire for the thing pictured, it is but a short step from the picture to the realization of it in physical or mental form. The World War brought out many startling tendencies of the human mind, which corroborate the work that psychologists have carried on in their research into the workings of the mind. The following account of a rough, unschooled, undisciplined young mountain man is an excellent case in point. From the editors. By including the following story of World War I hero Alvin York, as written by George W. Dixon, Napoleon Hill's intent was not just to tell the story of a hero, but also to illustrate his point that given a powerful enough stimulus, an individual can change his or her mind and thereby change his or her life. In the case of Alvin York, he went through two profound changes. The first, self-directed, and the second, inspired by others whom he respected. Though the modern person may find the storytelling style a little florid and melodramatic, the editors of this edition have chosen to repeat it exactly as it first appeared. Mr. Dixon's passionate literary style also says something about how powerfully affected the public of the day was by Alvin York's story of self-transformation. In 1941, York's story was made into the motion picture Sergeant York, starring Gary Cooper, a role for which Cooper won the Academy Award for Best Actor. Alvin York acted as a consultant on the film, so the events portrayed are not as overly dramatic or romanticized as many other Hollywood biographies. Sergeant York is available on video, and it still holds up as a well-made, powerful, and affecting movie. We now return to the text of the book as Hill quotes George Dixon's story. Fought for his religion, now great war hero. Rotarians plan to present farm to Alvin York, unlettered Tennessee squirrel hunter. By George W. Dixon. How Alvin Cullum York, an unlettered Tennessee squirrel hunter, became the foremost hero of the American Expeditionary Forces in France, forms a romantic chapter in the history of the World War. York is a native of Fentress County. He was born and reared among the hardy mountaineers of the Tennessee woods. There is not even a railroad in Fentress County. During his earlier years, he was reputed to be a desperate character. He was what was known as a gunman. He was a dead shot with a revolver, and his prowess with a rifle was known far and wide among the plain people of the Tennessee hills. One day, a religious organization pitched its tent in the community in which York and his parents lived. It was a strange sect that came to the mountains looking for converts, but the methods of the evangels of the new cult were full of fire and emotionalism. They denounced the sinner, the vile character, and the man who took advantage of his neighbor. They pointed to the religion of the master as an example that all should follow. Alvin gets religion. Alvin Cullum York startled his neighbors one night by flinging himself down at the mourner's bench. Old men stirred in their seats, and women craned their necks as York wrestled with his sins in the shadows of the Tennessee mountains. York became an ardent apostle of the new religion. He became an exhorter, a leader in the religious life of the community, and although his marksmanship was as deadly as ever, no one feared him who walked in the path of righteousness. When the news of the war reached that remote section of Tennessee, and the mountaineers were told that they were going to be conscripted, York grew sullen and disagreeable. He didn't believe in killing human beings, even in war. His Bible taught him, "Thou shalt not kill." To his mind, this was literal and final. He was branded as a conscientious objector. The draft officers anticipated trouble. They knew that his mind was made up, and they would have to reach him in some manner other than by threats of punishment. War in a Holy Cause. They went to York with the Bible and showed him that the war was in a holy cause, the cause of liberty and human freedom. They pointed out that men like himself were called upon by the higher powers to make the world free, to protect innocent women and children from violation, to make life worth living for the poor and oppressed, to overcome the beast pictured in the scriptures, and to make the world free for the development of Christian ideals and Christian manhood and womanhood. It was a fight between the hosts of righteousness and the hordes of Satan. The devil was trying to conquer the world through his chosen agents, the Kaiser and his generals. York's eyes blazed with a fierce light. His big hands closed like a vice. His strong jaws snapped. "The Kaiser," he hissed between his teeth. "The beast, the destroyer of women and children. I'll show him where he belongs if I ever get within gunshot of him." He caressed his rifle, kissed his mother goodbye, and told her he would see her again when the Kaiser had been put out of business. He went to the training camp and drilled with scrupulous care and strict obedience to orders. His skill at target practice attracted attention. His comrades were puzzled at his high scores. They had not reckoned that a backwoods squirrel hunter would make fine material for a sniper in the frontline trenches. York's part in the war is now history. General Pershing has designated him as the foremost individual hero of the war. He won every decoration, including the Congressional Medal, the Croix de Guerre, the Legion of Honor. He faced the Germans without fear of death. He was fighting to vindicate his religion, for the sanctity of the home, the love of women and children, the preservation of the ideal of Christianity, and the liberties of the poor and oppressed. Fear was not in his code or his vocabulary. His cool daring electrified more than a million men and set the world to talking about this strange, unlettered hero from the hills of Tennessee. Here we have a case of a young mountain man who, had he been approached from just a slightly different angle, undoubtedly would have resisted conscription and, likely as not, would have become so embittered toward his country that he would have become an outlaw, looking for an opportunity to strike back at the first chance. Those who approached him knew something of the principles through which the human mind works. They knew how to connect with young York by first overcoming the resistance that he had worked up in his own mind. This is the very point at which thousands of men, through improper understanding of these principles, are arbitrarily classed as criminals and treated as dangerous, vicious people. Through suggestion, these people could have been handled as effectively as young York was handled, and they could have developed into useful, productive human beings. In your search for ways and means of understanding and manipulating your own mind so that you can persuade it to create what you desire in life, let me remind you that, without a single exception, anything that irritates you and arouses you to anger, hatred, dislike, or cynicism is destructive to you. You can never get the maximum or even a fair average of constructive action out of your mind until you have learned to control it and keep it from becoming stimulated through anger or fear. These two negatives, anger and fear, are without question destructive to your mind. As long as you allow them to remain, you can be sure of results that are unsatisfactory and far below what you are capable of producing. In our discussion of environment and habit, we learned that the individual mind is amenable to the suggestions of environment and that the minds of the individuals of a crowd blend with one another, conforming to the suggestion of the leader or dominating figure. Following are comments by leading authorities that will give you a better understanding of the law of concentration as it is often used by those who wish to blend or fuse the minds of a crowd so they will function as a single mind. From the editors. In the original edition of The Law of Success, following the above introduction, Napoleon Hill included an extremely lengthy digression on religious revival meetings. As listeners to this book are well aware, Hill was intrigued by the workings of the mind, the study of psychology in general, and in particular, the serious study of hypnosis. To his dismay, the scientific work done in these areas was being abused. Hypnosis was falling into disrepute because stage magicians, who were extremely popular at that time, often used it as a part of their act. At the same time, the phenomenon of the religious revival meeting was sweeping America. Hill was very critical of the ways in which the leaders of these tent meetings manipulated the emotions of their followers by using the techniques of mass psychology and hypnosis to create the illusion of religious epiphany. Apparently, Hill felt that his readers needed to be warned of these abuses, and he extensively quoted numerous experts to support his position. At the time of this writing, revival meetings are far from being a widespread phenomenon. The magicians of note are creating grand illusions in the casinos of Las Vegas, and hypnosis has regained its status as a serious psychological technique used in hypnotherapy. Knowing that the listener to this edition is not in danger of being bamboozled, the editors have limited the number of repetitive supporting quotations. There are, however, some interesting points made in this quoted material about the mass psychology of revival meetings, which you may even have experienced at a seminar or workshop given by one of today's powerful motivational speakers. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Here Mr. J. A. Fisk gives us an interesting account of the influence of mental suggestion in a revival meeting. Mental suggestion in the revival. Modern psychology has firmly established the fact that the greater part of the phenomena of the religious revival are psychical rather than spiritual in their nature. The leading authorities recognize the fact that the mental excitement of the emotional appeals of the revivalist must be classified with the phenomena of hypnotic suggestion rather than with that of true religious experience. In fact, by some careful observers familiar with their respective phenomena, the religious revival meeting is classed with the public hypnotic entertainment. In order to understand the principle of the operation of mental suggestion in the revival meeting, we must first understand something of what is known as the psychology of the crowd. Psychologists are aware that the psychology of a crowd differs from that of the separate individuals composing that crowd. There is a crowd of separate individuals and a composite crowd in which the emotional natures of the unit seem to blend and fuse. The change arises from the influence of earnest attention or deep emotional appeals or common interest. When this change occurs, the crowd becomes a composite individual whose intelligence and emotional control is little above that of its weakest member. The predominant characteristics of this composite-mindedness of a crowd are the evidences of extreme suggestibility, response to appeals of emotion, vivid imagination, and action arising from imitation. Dial, in his Psychology of the Aggregate Mind of an Audience, holds that the mind of an assemblage listening to a powerful speaker undergoes a curious process called fusion, by which the individuals in the audience, losing their personal traits for the time being, are reduced, as it were, to a single individual whose characteristics are those of an impulsive youth, imbued in general with high ideals, but lacking in reasoning power and will. Tard, the French psychologist, advances similar views. Professor Joseph Jastrow, in his Fact and Fable in Psychology, says, "The conjurer finds it easy to perform to a large audience because, among other reasons, it is easier to arouse their admiration and sympathy, easier to make them forget themselves, and enter into the uncritical spirit of Wonderland." It would seem that in some respects, the critical tone of an assembly, like the strength of a chain, is that of its weakest member. Professor Gustave Le Bon, in his The Crowd, says, "The sentiments and ideas of all the persons in the gathering take one and the same direction, and their conscious personality vanishes. The most careful observations seem to prove that an individual immersed for some length of time in a crowd in action soon finds himself in a special state which most resembles the state of fascination in which the hypnotized individual finds himself. The conscious personality has entirely vanished. Will and discernment are lost. All feelings and thoughts are bent in the direction determined by the hypnotizer. Moreover, by the mere fact that he forms part of an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultured individual. In a crowd, he is a barbarian. That is, a creature acting by instinct. An individual in a crowd is a grain of sand amid other grains of sand, which the wind stirs up at will." Professor Frederick Morgan Davenport, in his book, Primitive Traits in Religious Revival, says, "The mind of the crowd is strangely like that of primitive man. Most of the people in it may be far from primitive in emotion, in thought, in character. Nevertheless, the result tends always to be the same. Stimulation immediately begets action. Reason is in abeyance. The cool, rational speaker has little chance beside the skillful, emotional orator. The crowd thinks in images, and speech must take this form to be accessible to it. It follows from this, of course, that appeals to the imagination have paramount influence. The crowd is united and governed by emotion rather than by reason." The explanation of this is that the attention of the crowd is always directed either by the circumstances of the occasion or by the speaker to certain common ideas, as salvation in religious gatherings, and every individual in the gathering is stirred with emotion. Not only because the idea or the shibboleth stirs him, but also because he is conscious that every other individual in the gathering believes in the idea or the shibboleth and is stirred by it, too. As Emil Durkheim observed in his psychological investigations, the average individual is intimidated by the mass of the crowd around him or before him, and experiences that peculiar psychological influence exerted by the mere number of people as against his individual self. Not only does the suggestible person find it easy to respond to the authoritative suggestions of the preacher and the exhortations of his helpers, but he is also brought under the direct fire of the imitative suggestions of those on all sides who are experiencing emotional activities and who are manifesting them outwardly. Human beings, in times of panic, fright, or deep emotion of any kind, manifest the imitative tendency of sheep and the tendency of cattle and horses to stampede under imitation. In both stage hypnosis and revival meetings, the attention and interest is attracted by the unusual procedure. The element of mystery and awe is induced by words and actions calculated to inspire them. The senses are tired by monotonous talk in an impressive and authoritative tone. And finally, the suggestions are projected in a commanding, suggestive manner familiar to all students of hypnotic suggestion. The subjects in both cases are prepared for the final suggestions and commands by previously given minor suggestions, such as in the case of the hypnotist, "stand up" or "look this way," and so on. And, in the case of the revivalist, by something like, "all those who think so-and-so, stand up," or "all who are willing to become better, stand up." The impressionable subjects are thus accustomed to obedience to suggestion by easy stages. And finally, the commanding suggestion, "come right up, this way, right up, come, I say, come, come, come," which takes the impressed ones right off their feet and rushes them to the front. These suggestions are almost precisely the same in the hypnotic experiment or seance on the one hand and the sensational revival on the other. Every good revivalist would make a good hypnotic operator, and every good hypnotic operator would make a good revivalist if his mind were turned in that direction. In the revival, the person giving the suggestions has the advantage of breaking down the resistance of his audience by arousing their sentiments and emotions. Tales depicting the influence of mother, home, and heaven tend to reduce one to the state of emotional response and render them most susceptible to strong, repeated suggestions along the same line. The element of fear is also invoked in the revival. The fear of a sudden death in an unconverted condition is held over the audience, and "Why not now? Why not tonight?" is asked. The persons who show signs of being influenced are then labored with by either the revivalist or his co-workers. They are urged to surrender their will and leave it all to the Lord. They are told to give yourself to God now, right now, this minute, or to only believe now and you shall be saved, or won't you give yourself to Jesus, etc. They are exhorted and prayed with. Arms are placed around their shoulders, and every art of emotional persuasive suggestion is used to make the sinner give up. Edwin Diller Starbuck, in his The Psychology of Religion, relates a number of instances of the experiences of converted persons at revivals. One person wrote as follows: "My will seemed wholly at the mercy of others, particularly of the revivalist. There was absolutely no intellectual element. It was pure feeling. There followed a period of ecstasy. I was bent on doing good and was eloquent in appealing to others. The state of moral exaltation did not continue. It was followed by a complete relapse from Orthodox religion." While there have undoubtedly been many instances of persons attracted originally by the emotional excitement of the revival and afterwards leading worthy religious lives in accordance with the higher spiritual nature, still, in too many cases, the revival has exerted but a temporary effect for good upon the persons yielding to the excitement, and after the stress has passed, has resulted in creating an indifference and even an aversion for true religious feeling. In others, there is merely awakened a susceptibility to emotional excitement, which causes the individual to undergo repeated stages of conversion at each revival, and a subsequent backsliding after the influence of the meeting has passed. Apply concentration to the law of success. By now, you will have learned that the one thing over which you have complete control is your thoughts. You may not be able to determine every circumstance of your life, but with concentration and accurate thinking, you can determine your reaction to those circumstances. The law of concentration is one of the major principles that must be understood and applied intelligently by all who would successfully experiment with what is described in this course as the mastermind. I have striven throughout this course to give you practical means for putting everything you learn to work. You have no doubt noticed that with each lesson, the ideas of the previous lessons have also been integrated. The Law of Success course is arranged in this manner so that understanding each new lesson also increases your comprehension of and ability to apply all the previous lessons. The Mastermind, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. With the aid of the mind, man has discovered many interesting facts about the earth on which we live, the air, and the endless space about us, and the millions of other planets and heavenly bodies that float through space. With the aid of a little mechanical contrivance, which man's mind conceived, called a spectroscope, man has discovered, at a distance of 93 million miles, the nature of the substances of which the sun is made. We have lived through the Stone Age, the Iron Age, the Copper Age, the Religious Fanatic Age, the Industrial Age, the Scientific Research Age, and now we enter the Age of Thought. Out of the spoils of the Dark Ages through which we have passed has come much material that is sound food for thought. While for more than 10,000 years the battle has raged between ignorance, superstition, and fear on the one side, and intelligence on the other, we have picked up some useful knowledge. Among the fragments of useful knowledge gathered, we have discovered and classified the elements of which all physical matter consists. By study and analysis and comparison, we have discovered the bigness of the material things in the universe as they are represented by the suns and stars, some of them over 10 million times as large as the Earth. And we have also discovered the littleness of things by reducing matter to molecules, then atoms, which are in turn made up of electrons that are themselves comprised of even smaller units, all constantly in rapid motion. Thus, it is said that in every drop of water and in every grain of sand, the entire principle upon which the whole universe operates is duplicated. How do we know these things to be true? Through the aid of the mind. In the physical or material world, whether one is looking at the largest star that floats through the heavens or the smallest grain of sand to be found on the earth, the object under observation is but an organized collection of molecules, atoms, and electrons. Man knows much about the physical facts of the universe. The next great scientific discovery may well be proof of my belief that in some way every human brain may be both a broadcasting and a receiving station, that every thought vibration released by the brain may be picked up and interpreted by all other brains that are in harmony with the rate of vibration of the broadcasting brain. I am of the opinion, and not without substantial evidence to support me, that it is possible for one to develop the ability of fixing their attention so highly that they may tune in and understand that which is in the mind of any person. But this is not all, nor is it the most important part of a hypothesis at which I have arrived after many years of careful research, for I believe that one may just as easily go a step further and tune in on the universal mind in which all knowledge is stored. To a highly orthodox mind, these statements may seem very irrational. But to the student who has studied the subject, these hypotheses seem not only possible, but also absolutely probable. Editor's comment. As was noted in An Introduction to the Mastermind in Volume 1 of The Law of Success, when Napoleon Hill was writing this book in 1928, the two founders of modern psychology, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, were still developing their theories of how the human mind worked. In the time since, much of Freudian psychology has been supplanted by other theories and techniques. But this is not true of Jung. If anything, Jungian psychology has gained greater acceptance. It is interesting to note that one of the cornerstones of Jung's theory is what he called the collective unconscious, a concept that is not dissimilar to what Hill is proposing here as well as in his explanations of the mastermind. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. How did we acquire the knowledge that we possess concerning the physical laws of this earth? How did we learn what has taken place before our time and during the uncivilized period? We gathered this knowledge by turning back the pages of nature's Bible and there viewing the unimpeachable evidence of millions of years of struggle among animals of a lower intelligence. By turning back the great stone pages, we have uncovered the bones, skeletons, footprints, and other unmistakable evidence that Mother Nature has held for our inspection throughout unbelievable periods of time. Now, we are turning our attention to another section of nature's Bible, a history of the great mental struggle that has taken place in the realm of thought. Thanks to education, meaning the unfolding and developing from within of the human mind, nature's Bible is now being interpreted. The story of humankind's long, perilous struggle upward has been written on the pages of this, the greatest of all Bibles. All who have partly conquered the six basic fears described in Lesson 3, and who have successfully conquered superstition and ignorance, may read the records that have been written in nature's Bible. Editor's comment. The six basic fears are the fear of poverty, the fear of old age, the fear of criticism, the fear of loss of love of someone, the fear of ill health, and the fear of death. They are explained in detail in Lesson 3 of Volume 1 and also in Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. In fact, he re-examined these fears in varying ways in most of his works. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Come for a short visit with a few of the powerful men who were making use of power created through the blending in a spirit of harmony of two or more minds. Henry Ford, Thomas A. Edison, and Harvey Firestone are men of great achievement in their respective fields of endeavor. Of the three, Henry Ford is the most powerful with reference to economic power. So great is his power that he may have anything of a physical nature that he desires or its equivalent. Millions of dollars to him are but playthings, no harder to acquire than the grains of sand with which the child builds sand tunnels. Mr. Edison has such a keen insight into Mother Nature's Bible that he has harnessed and combined, for the good of man, more of nature's laws than any other man who ever lived. Mr. Firestone's industrial achievement has made dollars multiply themselves so rapidly that his name has become a byword wherever automobiles are operated. All three men began their business and professional careers with no capital and but little schooling of the nature usually referred to as education. Perhaps Mr. Ford's beginning was, by far, the most humble of the three. Cursed with poverty and with lack of even the most elementary form of schooling and handicapped by ignorance in many forms, he has mastered all of these in the inconceivably short period of 25 years. Thus, might we briefly describe the achievements of three well-known successful men of power. But we have been dealing with effect only. The true philosopher wishes to know something of the cause that produced these desirable effects. It is a matter of public knowledge that Mr. Ford, Mr. Edison, and Mr. Firestone are close personal friends and that they go away to the woods once a year for a period of recuperation and rest. But it is not generally known, it is doubtful if these three men themselves even know it, that there exists between the three men a bond of harmony out of which has grown a mastermind that is being used by each of the three. A mind that has the capacity to tune in on forces with which most men are to no extent familiar. Let us repeat the statement that, out of the blending and harmonizing of two or more minds, 12 or 13 minds appear to be the most favorable number, may be produced a mind that has the capacity to tune in and pick up kindred thoughts on any subject. Through the principle of harmony of minds, Ford, Edison, and Firestone have created a mastermind that now supplements the efforts of each of the three, and whether consciously or unconsciously, this mastermind is the cause of the success of each of the three. There is no other answer to their attainment of great power and their far-reaching success in their respective fields of endeavor. And this is true despite the fact that none of them may be conscious of the power they have created or the manner in which they have done so. Editor's Commentary. Throughout this and the other volumes of The Law of Success, Napoleon Hill often names the same individuals and companies over and over when citing examples to illustrate how to apply the principles of success. These were the people Andrew Carnegie made available to Hill, and so when he spoke of how they use these principles, he did so from close observation and personal knowledge. It's interesting to speculate who Napoleon Hill might have written about had he been writing The Law of Success at the beginning of the 21st century. Which of the leaders of business and industry would he choose as examples of each principle of personal achievement? Had he known him, what would Napoleon Hill have had to say about someone such as Sir Richard Branson, one of the more interesting and unusual of today's billionaires, and renowned for his flamboyant, often outrageous, business and promotional style? Like Hill's examples above, Branson's school education was not extensive, but despite learning difficulties due to dyslexia, he was already coming up with business ideas while still in high school. In 1968, he and friend Johnny Gems created a newspaper called Student, selling subscriptions not just to students at their own school, but also to those at several other British schools. And like Hill's three examples, Branson also had no capital other than £4 from his mother for postage and telephone expenses. But with grand dreams and articles by such diverse contributors as government officials, musicians, and celebrities, they soon managed to sell corporate advertising. Soon afterward, when the British government lifted price controls on retail products, Branson noticed that none of the music stores were discounting records, so he ran ads in his newspaper offering discounted records by mail order. Finding that the record sales were more profitable than newspaper sales, he and Johnny acquired retail space above a shoe store by convincing the owner that their customer traffic would so greatly benefit his shoe business that it justified free rent. This was the first Virgin Record Store, so named by these virgins at business. Though Branson has retained that company name, the original reasoning was not applicable for long. Virgin has become such a well-recognized brand name that the majority of the companies in the Virgin Empire are partnerships with other companies wanting to benefit from that brand association. Singapore Airlines, for example, in 1999, purchased 49% of Virgin Atlantic Airlines. Despite his success, And with more than 300 business enterprises by 2002, Richard Branson has never had a corporate office or a corporate staff. His office, usually in one of his residences, is his notebook and a telephone. What is said to be Branson's most valuable asset is his ability to connect with people in the true sense of the mastermind and to empower their ideas to his own benefit as well as to theirs. He seems to create a new mastermind group with each new venture, bringing into it the people or companies best able to provide the necessary links. When Branson wanted to expand the Virgin brand into mobile phones, he did it as a co-venture with Britain's 1-to-1. When he decided to expand into e-commerce and being admittedly computer illiterate, who did he bring into this venture? None other than Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. There are aspects of this entrepreneur's story that are applicable to most all of Hill's principles, but we have chosen to mention Richard Branson in connection with this lesson because concentration and the mastermind principle seem to best exemplify, or perhaps be the only feasible explanation for, his determination and success in implementing his ideas to the degree he has. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. These men, whether by accident or design, have blended their minds in such a way that the mind of each has been supplemented by the power of the mastermind, and that mind has brought each of them more worldly gain than any person could possibly use. The law upon which the principle of a mastermind operates was discovered by Christ when he surrounded himself with 12 disciples and created the first 13 club of the world. Despite the fact that one of the 13, Judas, broke the chain of harmony, sufficient seed was sown during the period of harmony that originally existed between these 13 people to ensure the continuation of the greatest and most far-reaching philosophy known to the inhabitants of this earth. Many millions of people believe themselves to possess wisdom. Many of these do possess wisdom in certain elementary stages, but no one may possess real wisdom without the aid of the power of a mastermind. And such a mind cannot be created except through the principle of blending, in harmony, of two or more minds. Through many years of practical experimentation, it has been found that 13 minds, when blended in a spirit of perfect harmony, produce the most practical results. On this principle, whether consciously or unconsciously, is founded all of the great industrial and commercial successes that are so abundant in this age. The successful business and industrial and financial enterprises are those managed by leaders who either consciously or unconsciously apply the principle of coordinated effort described here. If you would be a great leader in any undertaking, surround yourself with other minds that can be blended in a spirit of cooperation so that they can act and function as one. If you can grasp this principle and apply it, you may have, for your efforts, whatever you want.